The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier, Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this week's very special guest on episode 118, can you believe it, 118, we're talking to Stephen Cohen, a reporter for the New Republic magazine out of Manhattan in the United States. We're talking narcos and we're talking the myth of Pablo Escobar. So this is a must-listen show to those of you out there who know anything about Colombian history, contemporary politics, and what the, let's say, war on drugs, so-called war on drugs, has done to Colombian society as a whole. It's a very interesting chat that we'll have coming up with Stephen Cohen, and I am particularly pleased to be able to get someone of this caliber and editorial noose here on the show. So I'm going to leave you with him very shortly. It's been a fascinating week, really, in terms of politics, and we're talking about it, talking about the FARC and their, when I say their intentions to get into mainstream politics, and their, let's say, ask, and a demand or ask or declarations of late that they would wish to get, let's say, almost mandatory seats in Congress for two terms, which even the left-wing politicians have spoken out against. Because how can you have people entering, and this is what they've said, not my words, but how can you have people entering uncontested into politics who have yet to go through the, let's say, the workings of transitional justice? It's an interesting situation. There's no doubt that members of the FARC, those who cannot be connected or have not been involved in any crimes against humanity, or crímenes de lesa humanidad, as they say here, crimes against humanity or any other things, could possibly be fast-tracked into politics and government. But I worry about what the knock-on effect is or will be if people get into politics without a popular vote. Now, part of the whole handover, let's say not handover, but transition into, a post-conflict Colombia, at least with the FARC, because the ELN have not sat down at the table yet, but at least with the FARC, is that there needs to be political participation. Yes, that's, you know, the first or the second point on the peace accords, but it's a very difficult situation when you think about it from this perspective. How are people going to react to two terms, so a total of 8 years, uncontested in Congress? I would assume that some people, those of us out there who are perhaps more open to reconciliation and reparation might think, well, yes, some former FARC members may be able to get into politics one term uncontested as a part of a transitional justice and a transition into a democratic process, an open political party. But two terms may be too long. You know, these people will need to face a popular democratic vote. Otherwise, it shows that you can get into politics and, you know, you can argue your corner and be there. But, you know, as a result of having taken up weapons and inflicted so much damage against the Colombian state. Anyway, it's a fascinating time, a bit troubling as well, but it's a fascinating time. And of course, it's all connected to what we're talking to with Stephen Cohen coming up in the next section of this show. We'll get him on the phone from Manhattan. But, yeah, all connected to Narcos and then this Netflix show that's, you know, won all the plaudits and is very popular outside of Colombia now. It's interesting to hear from someone who is a Colombiaphile and an expert on Colombia because he worked for Colombia Reports for a couple of years. So, yes, it's a reflection of perhaps how we feel, even myself as a foreigner, how we feel here in Colombia watching Narcos. So I think this is a really interesting show for those of you out there. And so get in touch. That's ColombiaCalling@gmail.com, ColombiaCalling at Twitter, or at ColombiaCalling on Twitter. We're on Facebook, and of course ColombiaCallingRadio.com is our website. Thank you for listening. Don't go away. We'll be right back with Stephen Cohen.
And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McColl here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And as with every week, we're here with a very special guest. Now, this is someone who knows Colombia very well. He was a writer first for Colombia Reports, the web-based news site that everything to do with Colombia comes up on. And then he became the editor. And indeed, those of you who remember way back in episode 3 or 4, if I'm not mistaken, we had Adrian Alselma, who is the director and the owner, I guess, of Colombia Reports, talking to us from Medellin. Quite controversial, to say the least. But this is one of, I would say, you know, one of his success stories, Stephen David Cohen, or Stephen Cohen, who has now moved on from Colombia Reports to the New Republic and is talking to us today from their offices in Manhattan. So welcome on Colombia Calling, Stephen.
Thanks so much for having me, Richard.
You're most welcome. You're most welcome. So let me know. So tell us, how did you decide to end up or start out at Colombia Reports in Medellin?
Well, a friend of a friend put me in touch with Adrian. From there, I started on as an intern and later as a reporter and then an editor. And after about a year, I ended up branching off and doing some freelance work on my own in Medellin.
That's pretty awesome, though. It's you were in Medellin for roughly 2 years.
Yeah, almost exactly 2 years.
But you were hang on a second. You weren't always involved then with Colombia Reports. You did your own thing and ended up writing for other publications as well.
I did, including the New Republic, even before I was signed on here.
Oh, that's perfect. But you mean you're a success story? So, but were you a qualified journalist before you came down?
I was not. I had never had any interest in journalism. I not so much as written for my school newspaper. Adrian's place in Columbia Reports is, it's a great place to start out. And, he really asks a lot of you and you pick it up as you go. And, Columbia is obviously a very challenging, context to start in as well. There's a lot going on and, you learn very quickly.
Well, high praise indeed. High praise indeed. And of course, fantastic. You should move on to such a magazine held in such high regard.
Yeah, well, the New Republic, I was lucky enough to write for them before coming here. And since I've been looking for an opportunity to write about Colombia again, which, I'm still very passionate about. And this show really gave me a good opportunity to do that. It's been in the conversation, as it were.
Thank you there. But now, so really, the reason that I've got you on the show, not only is because you know a lot about Colombia, but recently, you wrote and had published a piece about the Netflix show Narcos, which is, there have been a lot of pieces coming out, and you make reference to some of them, indeed, in your article.
Yeah,
you make reference to some of them and the people sort of blindly following, I guess, the flow, going with the flow, saying it's the greatest show ever, et cetera, et cetera. But for those of us perhaps who know a little bit more and more in depth about Colombia. The show is, I think my word would be lacking on some fronts, because there is an opportunity perhaps for it to go much deeper. But maybe, I don't know. What I think is your piece for The New Republic was the most coherent piece so far that has been written about Narcos. And maybe you could give us a little bit of a background of how you ended up writing the piece.
Well, I appreciate the praise. I watched the show. I didn't really have any expectations. I didn't even know it was coming out until after it already had. And then I was cruising on Netflix and saw it and started watching and was kind of immediately struck by the way it was conceived. I think, in writing this article, I sort of came to the conclusion that what's really wrong with Narcos is its conception. It's conceived very much as a show directed toward an American audience, which is fine, except instead of sort of challenging that audience's assumptions and all the baggage that an American audience is going to bring to a topic like Colombia, it plays into them and it reinforces them. And as I kind of kept watching in horror, and as the show went on, it sort of confirmed my early fears, which is that it was really buying into its own hype as being this super realistic depiction of Colombian history, which it definitely is not.
And I think that's interesting because, you know, it has been filmed for an American and European audience, let's say.
Yeah, that's true.
And I would not have watched six episodes of the first series. I don't believe I finished the series had I not been contacted by, a very good friend in Montreal, a few listeners of this podcast from the UK, all pointing me in the direction saying, oh, you've got to see it. It's amazing. It really gets you. It really illustrates the history and what was going on, and we're learning from it. And then, I watched six, which I felt was, doing perhaps it's a disservice to the show, but I thought I did myself a little bit of a disservice wasting so much time, because if I had chosen to see it personally and I watched one episode, I probably would not have then tuned in again. I've been here almost 10 years. One knows a lot about the history and the issues surrounding it. And of course, then the stereotypes, and they just seem to be perpetuated in this show. I don't know. Maybe I'm being too negative. Maybe that it's something that we should, maybe I should embrace it. They did indeed film in Colombia, lots of footage of the Candelaria and areas around there and Teusaquillo and Parkway and lots of footage. And yes, they did use some minor Colombian actors, but it just felt like there needed to be more. I don't know. Maybe you could deepen a little bit my superficial nature regarding it.
No, I think you're right. I think that was one of the things that was most disappointing about it, was that it could have been so much. It was filmed on location. It had a big budget. It had all the freedom, the creative freedom that comes with a sort of Netflix drama. And so there really was the potential to take an interesting approach to this topic, which has been depicted in so many different ways. Talking about the Pablo Escobar story, it's been depicted in so many different mediums and in so many different ways. And Narcos doesn't really do anything interesting or new with the material, even artistically, but then also from the historical perspective. It's a very, I think I say in the article, it's a very conventional drug war narrative. And that narrative ends up playing into, like I said, all of the sort of assumptions that an American or European audience is going to bring into the show to begin with, which is really the main disappointment.
Yeah, I think so. I think because it doesn't really cover new ground on that respect. Now, I want, talking from a purely sort of journalistic perspective on this one, how did your editors there at the New Republic take it when you said, this is what I want to do, this is what I'm thinking about? How did they take it?
Well, I had an editor who had actually watched the whole show and said that he was kind of waiting for someone to give this take on it, which was nice. And it had sort of been percolating in my own brain for a while. And like you, I had friends reach out to me and sort of with expectations, sort of saying, what do you think of the show? Or in some cases, giving it positive reviews. And eventually I felt like I had sort of reached a point where I felt like I had something clear to say about it. And And no, from there it was good. I think it's gotten some pretty positive reception and hopefully changed the way some people look at the material.
Yeah, hopefully, because, you know, there's that point as well. You know, Escobar in it is, let's just start with that. Let's start with the thing. He's a Brazilian actor, and it's really grating to hear him speak Portuñol, you know, hear that mix, that blend of Portuguese and Spanish. You know, that's for those of us who speak Spanish, of course.
I think that's sort of a really clear representation of what we were talking about earlier, is that what was the audience that this show had in mind?
Yeah.
They were sort of going for a pseudo realism by having a lot of the dialogue be in Spanish, but they didn't care enough about realism as artists to actually cast Colombian actors. And so you get, you know, Escobar's Brazilian, but then also there's, I think Carrillo, who's the main Colombian cop, is, I think, a Cuban American. Fabio Ochoa, another drug lord, an Escobar associate, is Brazilian also. You've got Gacha is Puerto Rican, and Mexicans, Argentines. It's just sort of a Latin hodgepodge, and anyone who knows anything about Latin America wouldn't find that convincing. But if you've got a sort of an audience that's not familiar with these things, then sure, it seems super realistic. But it shows you that Narcos doesn't have a very high estimation of its own audience's appreciation for the relevant context.
It's interesting, because I suddenly, you know, when I saw this, you know, is it Luis Guzman who was the gacha, Puerto Rican, is it?
Yeah, he's Puerto Rican. He's
okay. Who's the Latino in every movie ever made? I mean, basically, it's you know, he's from Boogie Nights to Carlito's Way, he's in it, you know. And but what I found so interesting is that maybe, you know, by casting these Argentines and Brazilians and so on and so forth, Mexicans, Cubans, maybe I thought, oh, maybe they're just reaching out for a huge Latin viewer base. Maybe that's what they're doing, trying to pull in through that sort of celebrity, that cult of celebrity, through the homegrown actors. But then at the end, I just think it's, you know, what you said, it's just a kind of lack of respect to a viewer perhaps in Colombia or Latin America.
I think you're right. I think that it might have been more strategic in trying to sort of expand the audience for the show. But I think if it's a pattern of just sort of this like half-assed realism, which is the only real aesthetic that the show goes for, is this vague realism, and they're not really committed to it from an artistic purpose, and then from a historical purpose, they completely buy into this very doctored narrative of the drug war and of Colombian history.
Yeah, and I have to say, just talking about the sort of way it's made, I do find the whole voiceover, I find that very difficult. I know, again, you know, I know it's supposed to bring people up to speed and educate them sort of while the show is moving on. You know, people aren't going to know about the bombing of the Avianca flight and so on. But I think of a friend of mine whose father was on that flight as well. He's like, you know, it was done with such... It was such a laissez-faire attitude that I was like, well, you know, if he were to watch this, what would he think? You know, that this person going on to the flight, and it was meant, you know, the bomb was meant to kill Gaviria and so on. I just felt when this voiceover and just the way it was treated in such a, it was lightweight. You know, that was hard.
Yeah, lightweight's a good way of putting it. I think, you know, the show, for people who haven't watched it, the show is narrated by Steve Murphy, who's the main character, and he's a DEA detective. I think the actual Steve Murphy is from West Virginia, but in the show, he's sort of vaguely Southern. And I think he really is supposed to be a stand-in for the viewer. I think that is who Narcos assumes their viewer is sort of white guy who's going to be impressed by the macho detective depiction that the show gives Murphy and his partner, Javier Pena. And all of these incredibly banal things that Steve Murphy has to say about Colombia, you know, banal and racist and offensive things that he has to say about Colombia and about how the politics work and about the bigger history and about what's going on between the U.S. and Colombia. you know, you keep waiting for the show to sort of take a stance against the narrator. And at a certain point, I sort of came to the conclusion that the show's politics are the same as Steve Murphy's politics, that, you know, the show doesn't really aspire to be anything greater than this kind of like ignorant white guy traveling to Colombia and being shocked at all of the crazy and inexplicable and unintelligible things he sees around him.
Well, that's it. You put it in there very succinctly as well when you made the reference to the whole magical realism as well. You know, it just sort of made it as an excuse. You know, of course, García Márquez is from here because that's the way it is. You know.
Well, yeah. So the show starts with this little text box giving a really bad definition for magical realism. And it's like so many other things on the show. It's really like Colombia itself, which is, like you said, is where the show is filmed. It's just sort of like a backdrop for the sort of cheap aesthetic that they're going for, which is very, I felt, was very orientalized, and Colombia is supposed to be mysterious and it has no real history. And everyone there is corrupt or is evil or is anonymous and just getting killed. And you're not really supposed to know anything about it. It's just supposed to be other and different and magical. And it's only magical because of the way the show depicts it. You know, Colombia is a complicated place and it has a special charm for people who have been there and who have lived there. But it's completely knowable, as complicated as it is. And depictions like this don't help the world appreciate Colombia and on a deeper level than the stereotypes that they already receive.
Very, very, very insightful words there, Stephen, and thank you for that. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to come back, though, and we're going to continue talking about Narcos. And I think it's time for us to delve a little bit more into the sort of the cult of the Pablo Escobar, you know, the image that surrounds, unfortunately, Colombia and why it's so inflated in this sense. But really interesting to hear it from you right here and now, and the thoughts behind the article and the editorial judgment that was used there at the New Republic. So therefore I am grateful for that, because I read it and I was like, God, thank God someone's written this piece. You know, so I don't have the editorial context to get a piece out there like that, but I have to say, you know, someone had to do it, you did it, and it's excellent. So I will direct you all, my listeners out there, to look onto the Facebook page, because I have linked to Stephen Cohen's piece about Narcos in the New Republic. So we're going to take a short break. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McCall. We're talking to Stephen Cohen, and we'll be right back, and we will continue talking about Narcos and Pablo Escobar. So don't go away. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McCall here in Bogota, talking to Stephen Cohen, who's in Manhattan, who's in the very offices of the New Republic magazine up there. And we've got Stephen on this show because he wrote a very very interesting, very insightful piece for his magazine, the magazine where he works, about the Netflix show Narcos. And so we're sort of unraveling it a bit. We're just showing you that it's not everything. And I know a lot of the people out there who listen to this show have indeed watched Narcos. I have been contacted by some of you out there saying it's the greatest thing. It's really interesting. I can't wait, you know, to see the next. Now, Stephen, I just want to ask one thing. Do you know if Narcos is getting a second season?
I believe it's already been approved for a second season.
Oh, really? And is it going to, well, it can't focus on Escobar, I suppose. It'll have to be on like the Cali cartel or someone else, no?
Well, the show ends with Escobar escaping from his self-constructed prison, La Catedral. And so this next season, I presume we will get to see more of the Cali cartel because of the role that the Cali cartel plays in hunting down Escobar. Although I'm sure, given the way Narcos has depicted everything else so far, they'll find some way of downplaying that role or distorting it.
Such high hopes you have there. Now I wanted to talk a little bit about this, because, you know, when I first came to Colombia in 1998 or whatever it was back there, you know, people would say you're going to be kidnapped, and then, you know, I got sort of pictures here and there and some offers for some articles for CNN and so on. And I had to put the word narco terrorist Pablo Escobar and so on. I mean, he's the name. Everybody knows who he is or who he was. Maybe he still remains, because he's a character that's larger than life in, I would say, almost contemporary sort of pop culture. You know, it's a what is this cult around Pablo Escobar, and why is he? Why would you think, Stephen, that he is the one to always be depicted when they talk about cartels and you know the larger than life character? Why did Pablo Escobar? Why did he take all of the headlines?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. And I was trying to think about it a little bit while I was writing this article. So I think part of the reason is just, you know, who Pablo Escobar actually was. He did have these very grandiose ambitions. He did want to be involved in politics. He did see himself as sort of a savior figure for Colombia. And he was very convinced of all of this. And then he also, you know, he had the giant estates with the hippopotami or the hippopotamus and the zebra and the, you know, the cars. And, so he fit that whole, you know, lavish lifestyle. And, he also played into the Robin Hood myth for his own purposes. So he, you know, he built entire neighborhoods in Medellin. He was a prodigious benefactor of the poor in that city. And so all of this, he did consciously create his own mythology. And I think that's part of it. I think the other part of it, which is something that you find out more as you read more about this stuff, is that, Escobar was like very deliberately targeted at the time by the US government and by the Colombian government. And so his menace, this image that exists around him was also inflated for propagandistic purposes. Especially once he was killed, it has since become in the interest of the United States to hold him up as this sort of like giant pelt on the wall, of like, we got this guy and, look at what a great success that is. And so, yeah, I think like the captivation, that he holds in the popular imagination has kind of dovetailed with the politics of the drug war that led to his killing.
Yeah, it's right. Like you said, that one point there, that he created the sort of the mythology around himself. Now, I have a, you know, personal anecdote about that. When back in the day when I went to Medellin and had to write a piece, and then obviously ended up at the cemetery where he's buried, and I took photos of the people who were visiting. There were people lining up to pay their respects. And not tourists, people from Medellin. And yes, these were humble people who said, yes, he was the Papa de los Pobres, because of course they lived in the area which benefited from him. Of course, it's not for me to, you know, push my politics or my thoughts on this, at these people who benefited directly from him. But I found it really amazing to see that even in 98, 2000, around that time, people still doing that. It just, like you say, we moved into the political side of it all, and the US hanging, holding him up there as like the big scalp or the pelt. That's the word you use, but the big target and the success story. But at the same time, I mean, there were other really huge cartels with, again, involved in the most nefarious deeds, and possibly arguably even worse. But Escobar was, I guess he's called him, you know, he was the sort of poster boy for it all.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's another thing too, is that like who Pablo Escobar is within Colombia is a very different thing than who he is in the US. In the US, he's sort of this commodity, this sort of Scarface icon. Whereas in Colombia, the however you feel about him, it tends to come from, you know, personal experience. There are people who lost family members or friends in two bombs that he set off in Bogota when he was fighting extradition. And then, in Medellin, I lived right below Barrio Pablo Escobar, which is literally a neighborhood that was constructed on top of a garbage heap in Medellin, and which still bears his picture and his iconography all over the walls. And, you can talk to people in Medellin and they'll tell you, oh yeah, you know, I used to cut his hair and he was so generous, or, everyone sort of has their own personal connection, but, there's a big dissociation between, the way that Colombians talk about him and the way that he's conceived of by Americans that don't have that same personal attachment.
It's interesting, isn't it? And this month, the Economist has run, or this week, the Economist has run a series of articles about Colombia, and mainly it's about sort of the peace dialogues, ongoing peace dialogues between the FARC guerrillas and the government, and the possible accord reached, and bilateral ceasefire, and you know, all of this sort of stuff. But there is a paragraph where the writer says, you know, that to think that there's such a mainstream Netflix show such as Narcos and almost glorifying a bit, you know, Pablo Escobar, is distasteful, and that's what the journalist said. It's distasteful, but the fact that you know, we've come so far to be able to, you know, for Colombians to also be able to watch this and have an opinion on it means that, you know, Colombia is sort of turning a corner and moving on. I don't know if I'm fully on board with that train of thought, but I found it very interesting. I found it very interesting indeed. And, you know, maybe even in as much as it's the show and the cult around Pablo Escobar may be distasteful and poorly made and poorly investigated, but perhaps it gives Colombia a chance to move on. What would you say about that, Stephen?
Well, I don't know. I think the Colombian depictions of Pablo Escobar as well can also be problematic for some of the same reasons. So, like, you know, Colombia has there was the popular show that was almost sort of like a telenovela, El Patrón del Mal, about Escobar, and in some senses, I think from what I've seen of it, and I've only seen episodes, but I think it also sort of trivialized and commodified Escobar in some of the same ways. I think one thing that's worth pointing out also is that, you know, the show Narcos doesn't even depict the FARC guerrilla, which is also fairly incredible. That there's, you know, it might be incredible how to the Economist how this show was received in Colombia, but it's pretty incredible to have a popular show that pretends to give a large history of Colombia without even mentioning those aspects of the history.
It is pretty incredible, actually, and it's a remarkable oversight. And of course, I can just imagine the sort of producers sitting there going, hang on, you've got the Quintin-Lame, the FARC, the ELN, the EPL, the M19, and just going, this is going to be too complicated for an international audience. I can really imagine them sitting there and saying, yeah, just cut it all, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that's probably how it went. But what you end up with is, you know, there is one guerrilla group in the show, and it's the M19, which was an urban guerrilla group that was very popular and had a fairly significant military presence as well as a political aspect, and has since been incorporated into the mainstream. And there are senators, and there have been presidential candidates that were former guerrillas. And the way the show depicts it is if these people were just puppets of Pablo Escobar. They didn't have their own goals. It was completely detached from the history of conflict of the armed conflict in Colombia, which was a myth that was very purposely propagated by the United States in the interest of fighting the Cold War. They were sort of obsessed with this Narco guerrilla connection, this supposed link between the drug dealers and communism, which in the show they sort of stumble on as an accident, but in reality was very actively being pressed by the U.S. government. What you end up with, the one group that they do choose to pick has also been completely cut out from the actual relevant context, which is just, you know, another example of the show's sort of really bad politics.
Now, talking about politics, and I think this is an important thing that we need to discuss, is you know, when we talk about the cult of Pablo Escobar, and you mentioned it, of course, he, you know, around the myth, he wanted to get into politics, and of course he did win his seat and so on. It's curious because it makes me think of the social strata system here in Colombia, And, you know, to become a senator, congressman, then senator, or, you know, up there, high ranking, that is the equivalent, I guess, in Colombia of, you know, becoming part of the royal family, part of the elite. That's the only way that you can sort of, in my mind, that you can break that ceiling of the social strata. And that, I think that's what a lot of the Pablo Escobar myth is trying to break that and get through. And of course, once he got into, you know, won his votes, won his seat, you know, I think that the elite in Bogota wanted none of it, really, did they? They didn't want this guy from the provinces, because it was Medellin back in the day. And of course, his money, I don't really think that anyone really cared where his money came from, because it's kind of Colombia in that period. But equally, what I'm trying to grapple with here is this whole idea of the elite system in Colombia. Did you look at that in any way in the article? I don't recall.
I'm not sure what I said about it in the article. I mean, you know, of course, all of these politicians were perfectly happy to accept narco money when it just was going to their own campaigns. And yes, that when Pablo Escobar tried to launch himself as a political candidate, that was one of the decisions that actually led to the political backlash against him and that brought him down. But yeah, you know, like if we're talking about... if we want to really understand the Escobar myth or the Escobar phenomenon or any of these things that the show tries to depict, we have to start with the context, with the real political context behind this. So this is a country in which there has been immense power vacuums created by the ruling classes, just general disinterest in actually providing institutional protection and services to its own people. And so when you ask, you know, well, how is it that in Medellin there are still people who worship this guy? Because these are people who have never come into real favorable contact with their own government. Both Escobar as well as some of these guerrilla groups were filling that void in different ways. And there have been any number of groups in Colombia that have occupied that space where the state should be but isn't. And that is still true today, and it's still true then. And that is something that Narcos is profoundly uninterested in showing in any meaningful way.
Yeah, you're true. No, you said it far more eloquently than I. So thank you for that one. Now, when we talk about this, it's going to keep going on, though, this repetition, I think, of hackneyed shows about the period. I just don't think it's something that will ever get put behind us, especially for those of us here in Colombia. You lived in the barrio just below the barrio Pablo Escobar. Did your barrio make up part of the Escobar tour? Are they still doing those in Medellin?
I'm sure they are. I haven't had the pleasure of going on one of those expeditions, but I never saw any tour groups passing through. But
there are those offering it, you know, and they're still one of the most. I know that, you know, when some friends of mine who did start the tour, that they got the most amount of hits from, you know, internationally, because they got linked into various other media around the world. I know the Guardian picked it up. I'm sure the New York Times picked it up and everything. But then, you know, their website went through the roof. I don't think they even offer it anymore, but I'm sure there's still people there in Medellin offering it. And someone got in touch with me via, you know, over Twitter asking about it. And I went, well, I don't really know anything about that. And I guess I don't mind that there's a tour if it's not glorifying him and if it enables people to see the bigger picture. But I just don't think that any tour would ever do that. What would your opinion on this be?
Well, I think it depends. I mean, I think you see all sorts of things like that. I mean, you see people, there are people down in El Centro in Medellin who are selling Escobar paraphernalia, t-shirts, you know, hats, stuff like that. And you know, you can even ask them about this stuff, and they'll tell you that it's just because, you know, they know that gringos go crazy for it. And you know, people in Colombia are extremely resourceful about finding ways to make money. I find that very hard to judge. Narcos does something that is very different, which is commodifying Escobar from the outside. So, you know, coming in and then taking this very painful history and wrapping it up in a very attractive, well-edited, well-shot little bow and delivering it to an American audience for their own benefit. And they're not, I'm sort of skeptical about arguments that that fiction owes any sort of inherent, has any inherent obligation to be accurate. But there are bigger political dynamics at play here. Narcos is very willfully ignorant of all of them, and is happy to just sort of to benefit from very stereotyped images of Colombia, of Colombians, and of very decontextualized depiction of the drug war, which this American audience isn't has a say in, has a direct role in propagating. I mean, these are really U.S. politics that have been imposed on Colombia. So this isn't an audience with no stake in what they're watching.
This is true. And you make mention in your piece about Pinochet, the Southern Cone, Bolivia, Peru. Perhaps you'd like to explain a little bit about, well, you know, briefly, because otherwise we'd be here for hours, but briefly, sure, a little bit about, you know, a nice package it up well.
Well, yeah. So like I said in the article, and like I said earlier in our conversation, there's a moment in the show where Steve Murphy, our hero detective, discovers this Narco Guerrilla conspiracy. Now, if you actually study the history of the drug war, the whole idea of Narco Guerrilla was literally cooked up in the White House at a time when the White House was using the Colombian drug trade to fund the Nicaraguan Contra Revolution, illegally against the express orders of Congress, and also using arms sales to Iran, what sort of became known as the Iran-Contra conspiracy. I think a lot of Americans have a general sense of what that entailed, but the truth is that this was part of a much longer history that stretches back all the way to World War II and even before, of using narcotics to fund and to execute special operations. There's a number of reasons why that's very convenient for U.S. foreign policy objectives. A lot of these narco mafias obviously can operate in ways in which an official government cannot. The funding can be off the books. They have access to a lot of funding. And so these sort of alliances which are created in Colombia between right-wing political interests like right-wing death squads and the narco mafia is actually part of a much larger pattern that stretches back decades and continues in many ways to this day.
This is true. And of course, you've written not so long ago as well about the Chiquita brand in northern Colombia, the Chiquita, I guess, fruit brand, banana brand, and so on. I mean, it's linked to everything, isn't it, really?
Well, sure, yeah. So, you know, multinational corporations who were doing business and are doing business in Colombia have been widely accused very credibly of having cooperated with these death squads as well. And, you know, there's plenty of evidence for that. In Chiquita's case, there's thousands of pages of documents detailing the payments that were made to a group that helped the DEA kill Pablo Escobar and that proceeded to take over the drug trade from him, and that was massively intertwined with the government in its mission to eliminate the left-wing guerrilla groups in Colombia. Its ostensible mission, I should say, because there are economic interests that were being served, obviously, by these activities as well.
Go on, please.
No. So yes, we are talking about, you know, a very pervasive system of complicity, and I think any serious depiction of the drug trade would have to start with that. And I think what's a shame from talking about narcos is that there's so much about that history that, by its very nature, we don't really understand. So there's plenty that we do know, and then there's also big gaping holes in the historical record because the agencies that are involved in these sorts of practices are very secretive and guard their secrecy. And so there was room to flesh out that history, to sort of bring an imaginative approach and to dramatize the parts of history that we might not know, but that we have a general sense of what they entail. And instead, the only areas in which Narcos shows any semblance of imagination, it's to really depict the propaganda myths that were propagated by the U.S. government. So it goes from being sort of an innocent and naive depiction of a third world country by and I would say, you know, a racist and very condescending depiction of a third world country, to being almost a tool of U.S. foreign policy in a very pervasive and perverse way, I would say.
I think that's an incredibly correct and yes, astute observation. And of course, it's done by somebody who knows a lot about Colombia and has spent time here. And I think that we do well to you know, dwell on this further, and do well to, someone needs to come up and say, you know, what about a proper show about this? I know that Colombian history and Colombian issues are very complex, but at the same time, you know, these superficial displays don't do us any favors at all. And now I'm worried about, because I know that we've been having reports of Tom Cruise down here in Medellin and so on, and you know, filming. I doubt that he's going to do it any justice either. I mean, it's just, I think, isn't he doing a film about Pablo Escobar's pilot?
I think he's the latest in a long line of people lining up to do some sort of Pablo Escobar spinoff. I think what's important to recognize is that these depictions, these stereotype, these decontextualized depictions of Colombia and of the history have a real world effect. They're not simply innocent, and they're not simply it is not just okay that they're wrong, because they're wrong in a very specific way, in a way that has real world political implications. So Colombia is still constantly held up as this example of success in the drug war. And as Javier Pena and the real Javier Pena and Steve Murphy have said in interviews, we are still implementing these policies in Mexico, in Central America, under the pretense that they worked so well in Colombia. So getting the history this wrong is not, it is not trivial, and it's not merely innocent, because there is a bigger context, that the audience itself is part of, and understanding the real history behind these things is important to not repeating the same mistakes, that have terrible and wrenching effects on real people's lives. You would not know that from Narcos, because Narcos isn't very interested in showing the effect that all of this has had on Colombia and continues to have on Colombia. But these same mistakes are being repeated in different areas of the world, and there will be more Pablo Escobar stories, and there will be more victims that come along with them.
Yes, I think that's a perfect way to end, because you really summed it all up, and you've really given us quite an excellent insight into the reality behind it all, and you know, the damage done by a show such as Narcos. If it had only just adopted a bit more, you know, maybe if it just decided to shoulder a bit more responsibility in terms of displaying the complexities of the Colombian situation, I think we would be having a different conversation today. So let me just take this moment, Stephen, and say thank you very much for being on the show, and thank you very much for sharing your quite considerable knowledge on the subject.
No, thank you so much for having me.
You're most welcome. Please, everyone, read the piece. It's in the New Republic. It's by Stephen Cohen. It's about the unreal situation of Narcos, the Netflix show that's available, obviously, to everyone out there, and the damage that it has done, and in not telling the whole story. So I'm going to bring this show to an end right now and say thank you for listening. Thank you to Stephen Cohen up there in Manhattan at the offices of the New Republic. public. And of course, I look forward to hearing your thoughts about this show. Those of you listeners out there, you can get in touch. That's columbiacalling@gmail.com. Website is columbiacallingradio.com. Of course, we're on Twitter and Facebook. I've been Richard McCall. This has been Columbia Calling, and we've been speaking to Stephen Cohen of the New Republic in Manhattan. Thank you and goodbye.